Well, good morning, everybody. It is 8:06 on your Monday morning, July 19th. I'm Sean Higgins at the KPCW studios in Park City, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher this week. 66 degrees at our studio in Old Town Park City, 63 down in Heber, and on the line with a full forecast, we have meteorologist Cesar Cornejo with the ABC Forecast Center down in Salt Lake City. Good morning, Cesar.
Good morning. So far right now, we can expect to see that we have some clouds building in. Thank you, monsoon moisture. Hello, monsoon season, as we expect to see that we have shower activity building in towards the afternoon hours and even going into tonight. We'll see a high of 79 with a low of 61. Tuesday, we can also expect to see shower activity be on the likely side. So thunderstorms are expected, and by the time we get towards Tuesday night, they start to die down as we start to see our moisture wane throughout the overnight hours for a little bit. We'll see a high of 76, low of 62. Wednesday, we can expect to see sunny skies during the morning time, and then we start to have the chance of some afternoon thunderstorms for us. We'll see a high of 80 degrees. Wednesday night, start to slowly die down again. These are all daytime storms. We get that sunshine helping us lift that air. It creates those thunderstorms for us. They start to die down by the evening. We'll see a low of 63 with partly cloudy skies. Thursday, we do it all over again. Mostly sunny skies during the early afternoon hours. Start to see some thunderstorm chances billow up. Thursday night continues for us a little bit. Then we start to dry out a bit more. We'll see a high of 79 and low of 63. Friday, we can expect to see a return of thunderstorms once again throughout most of the afternoon hours and evening. We'll see a high of 78 with partly sunny skies. We'll also see that we'll stay around the mostly cloudy side after the thunderstorms start to die down for us with a low of 62. Saturday, we continue to see plenty of thunderstorm activity once again, partly sunny skies for us that day. We'll see a high of 77. And for Saturday night, we can expect to see that the thunderstorms start to die down once again, mostly cloudy skies, plenty of moisture in our atmosphere, and we'll see a low of 61. Sunday, we do it all over again. Afternoon thunderstorms, a bit more on the heavier side for us. We continue to see that monsoonal moisture make its way in, partly sunny skies, and we'll see a high of 76. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Over to you.
All right, Cesar, thank you. Well, good morning, Summit in Wasatch County's 8:08 on your Monday morning. Coming up on this hour's local news hour, with the 2020 Tokyo Olympics preparing to open later this week, Friday, actually, Park City resident and 1964 Olympic gold medalist Dick Roth will join to look back on the Tokyo Games of his youth. The division president of real estate developer CW Urban, Darlene Carter, will be building 38 affordable condos in the Silver Creek Village. And the Snyderville Basin Recreation Director, Dana Jones, will be on with a monthly update. All that starting at 8:15. We're on to local news now. Park City's Miners' Day celebration is still 6 weeks away, but Rotary Club members have set their plans to resume the town's 125-year-old holiday tradition. Rick Bruff has more.
Tom Kelly from Rotary told KPCW that the festivities are coming back after the pandemic last year forced them to cancel Miners' Day festivities, or at best, hold them virtually. Miners' Day, September 6th, kicks off with the usual events such as breakfast at City Park, the Bark City 5K run, and a parade with costumes and floats. The major highlight is Rotary's annual Running of the Balls, where organizers release thousands of balls from the top of Main Street before cheering throngs. Beforehand, patrons can pay to sponsor one ball or many, and if their ball is one of the top finishers at the bottom of the street, they're eligible for prizes. Kelly said last year they held a virtual version of the running. It's one of their most important fundraisers.
This is where we raise our money for our nonprofits in the community. And if we go back a year, we were really struggling as a Rotary Club trying to figure out how are we going to make grants to our local nonprofits who are in the biggest need position of ever. And we came up with a concept of doing limited balls last year. We came up in the dark of one morning before anybody was on Main Street, and we actually conducted a running of the balls that was videotaped and put on Park City television. And we ended up raising $30,000. And this money went to scholarships for students from Park City, and right now we're in the final stages of our granting process, and we're going to be granting another $10,000 to local nonprofits.
You can purchase a ball now by going to parkcityminers.org. They're also available in coming weeks from any Rotarian. at Silly Market or in person on the day of the event. Kelly said the running of the balls takes place between 10:30 to 11 a.m. on Miner's Day, followed by the Miner's Day Parade at 11. He said those are approximate times since this is Part City. For the parade and the rest of the holiday this year, Kelly said the message is that this is Part City's festival. Residents and their friends can walk in the parade for free, as can local nonprofits. Kelly said there's a charge for politicians and corporate entities.
What we'd really like to do this year is just challenge neighborhoods in the Park City and the greater Snyderville Basin and Summit County to get together with your friends, bring your wagons, your dogs, find some crazy funky costumes, and just walk down Main Street. Pretend you're miners of old or whatever you want to do. This is our town, and let's celebrate it together.
Afterwards, there's entertainment, food trucks, and games at City Park. Kelly said one change is that the traditional miners' mucking and drilling competition is now a demonstration. He said there are not many people around today with skills in drilling or mucking, that is, shoveling the broken rock into ore cars. Kelly said starting at 12:30, they will have three or four mucking and drilling demonstrations that afternoon. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, for those planning to visit the Dordnell State Park, know before you go, some swimmers are getting an irritating but harmless rash there. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on what is leaving swimmers itchy and how it relates to the current low water levels.
Swimmers at the Dordnell Reservoir have recently reported getting rashes known as swimmer's itch. Health officials say swimmer's itch is caused by a microscopic larva called Cercariel. It causes an allergic reaction on some people's skin, but is otherwise not harmful. The rash can last around a week and is treatable with anti-itch cream. Chris Smoot is an epidemiologist with the Wasatch County Health Department. He says while swimmers probably want to avoid getting it, they shouldn't worry for their health.
It could cause that rash, but it won't go any further. So a person doesn't actually become infected. It's just a reaction to those little larvae trying to complete their life cycle.
The larvae rely on snails as part of their life cycle. Because snails tend to prefer shallow water, that's where swimmers are most likely to be exposed.
So they can survive in water. They typically are going to hang out in the shallower areas. Yeah, so in marshy areas or just kind of the shallow areas where these snails are going to live, right? Because that snail's that intermediate host. So you need to have these aquatic snails in order to have these larvae hatch and then go into the water.
The swimmer's itch reports came from people who swam in shallow water west of the personal watercraft ramp near the Park City Sailing Association. Officials say people can avoid it by swimming out farther in deeper water. Devin Chavez of the Utah Department of Natural Resources says this is the first time he's seen this occur in the Dordnell. He says it's likely a symptom of the reservoir's low level. It's currently about 67% full.
A decrease in overall lake size of, you know, water has a couple of different things, like swimmer's itch because of the heat and because of, you know, less water means in cases with swimmer's itch, it's often attached to waterfowl and birds and things like that. So when there's less potable water, there's more increase of people coming into contact with things like that.
The DNR warns that Utah reservoirs are alarmingly low and draining quickly this summer. Rain scarcity and a weak snowpack last winter have been the main contributing causes to low water levels. Other reservoirs where people are getting swimmer's itch include Sand Hollow, Palisade Lake, and the new pond at Willard Bay. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, the Tokyo Olympics will kick off this Friday. Park City resident Dick Roth is a former swimmer, Olympic champion, and world record holder in two events. He swam in the 1964 Olympic Games in Tokyo, where he won a gold medal for his first place finish in the men's 400-meter individual medley and set a world record in the process. He joins us in the studio to talk about his Tokyo experience. Good morning, Dick, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So do you still get goosebumps thinking about your Olympic experience and that gold medal?
Yes, I do, right? I just, all you had to do is mention it.
So as I was reading about you this morning, and I understand you actually got appendicitis before you swam in the Olympic final?
Pretty crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, so walk us through that. Was like, I mean, that requires surgery. How did that happen?
The evening of the opening ceremonies, all tired and not feeling well, and tried to go to bed early, couldn't sleep, and got about 5 in the morning, I woke up with this huge pain in the lower right side of my belly and went down to the infirmary and got poked around by the nurses and doctors, and they sent me to the hospital. It was one of the scariest moments of my entire life, as you can imagine. And as they got me all on the gurney and IV'd up and ready to go, and I just said, no, you can't do it. And I was only 17, so they had to, you know, they were all shocked, and tried to get the Olympic Committee to okay the surgery, and finally they had to find my parents, who came in, and after about 8 hours in the hospital on a gurney with the IV in my arm, my parents refused, and they sent me back to the Olympic Village, and I swam in the trials of the race the next day, did terribly, way, way bad, but I made the finals, and I stayed in bed for 2 days. I couldn't eat anything but Jell-O and Hawaiian Punch. Not the ideal. And came up to the day of the race. I was okay. Temperature was down, and I got released back to my room and went on to swim that evening. And fortunately, I won.
You won, and you set a world record in the process. Do you think that was just luck, or was that just a pure adrenaline that was coursing through your veins that allowed you to do that?
It was a lot of different things. Adrenaline was one of the really big ones.
Absolutely. So I understand you actually attended Stanford after your Olympic experience.
I did.
What was it like? Were you a bit of a celebrity around campus as an Olympic gold medalist, or was the celebrity status of Olympians and gold medals a little bit less back then than it is now?
I was a celebrity. There's no question about it. I by the time I got to Stanford, I was getting pretty tired of it. You do get tired of it, believe me. But yeah, I was the big man on campus, at least during my freshman year.
Wonderful. And I know these games are a little different than back in 1964 for a number of reasons. Not only have we been through, or still going through, a global pandemic, the world has changed so much in the last 50 so years since the Olympics were last in Tokyo. What are your thoughts on these games, given everything that's happened over the past year and a half, 2 years?
Well, I'm just glad we're having him. It's been, a year of postponement, which is just, I can't even imagine what it would be like as an athlete to go through that, to be all prepped and ready to go, and you have your timeline and everything. But they're happening, and I'm glad for that. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing for an athlete, maybe twice, or if you're Simone Biles or Michael Phelps, several times in a lifetime. But for the athletes, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary experience, and mm-hmm. I'm glad we have it.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about that. You said you might have a second chance nowadays. The Olympics themselves have changed a lot in the years, too. It used to be all amateurs. Now you have a lot of professional athletes who are allowed to compete. You said you were 17 when you started, and now you're like a guy like Michael Phelps, competed in several Olympics. And how have the games changed, whether it's social media or just how produced they are now, the money that's involved? How has things changed in the last several years?
Well, it's the money. I think it's changed it dramatically, and it's not nearly as much about the athlete as it used to be in the athletic accomplishments, and I'm sorry for that. I wish that we would have more about the achievements of the award and of the games, and it makes me kind of sad, actually.
And what would you tell Olympians and young athletes now who are preparing to compete on this, the biggest stage they will likely compete in their entire lives?
It's just another meet. It's just another event. Go inside yourself, do your regular pre-race or pre-event, whatever they call it these days. Back then, that was just get ready for your race. It is the biggest event you'll ever swim in or compete in, and understand that, but try not to focus on it. Just do what you need to do.
Mm-hmm. And given that you were a swimmer, obviously there are dozens of events in the games. Is the athletic mindset kind of the same across sports and across events? Are there parallels between a swimmer and a track and field athlete, or a swimmer and a gymnast?
Absolutely, especially at the Olympics. This is the zenith. This is the apex. This is what you've been training for 3 or 4 or 10 years, and you just need to go for it, to do your normal thing. And yes, it's the world's biggest stage. Don't let that get to you. You can do your regular thing and do very, very well, perhaps even win.
Mm-hmm. And given how much the experience of being an Olympian affects you, how did you take that mindset into the rest of your life? That competitive mindset, did it help you in your professional life? Did it help you as a student learning that work ethic of training? And did you take that into your schooling? How did that experience as an Olympian influence the rest of your life?
It definitely helped, influenced, even controlled at times the way I approached life. And that could be a blessing or a curse. Trying to beat everybody when you don't need to is a pointless task. And I got really good at that. And I had to really go inside and try and become a normal person again, which took me a long time. It took a long time to get past the I gotta beat everybody at everything, which ended up being kind of a curse and a blessing. A blessing, then a curse, then a blessing again. It's a wonderful, wonderful ability and talent to have, and it can really lead you into an egoistic corner that can isolate you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In Utah and Park City in particular, perhaps more known for their Winter Olympians, but we do have a few local Olympians competing in Tokyo this year. Park City's Haley Batten will be on the mountain bike team. What would you tell local Olympians heading into the games this week?
This is something that you want to be completely prepared and ready for, but also treat it like any other race. You forget that it's the Olympics when you get up on that on your starting position, and just go out and do your absolute best, like you would in any big race. That's the important thing, not the pomp and circumstances and the the amazing publicity. Just go be yourself and do what you know how to do.
Mm, absolutely. Anything else you want to share with us this morning, Dick?
I am overwhelmed by the Olympic experience, and I am overwhelmed that we had the games here in 2002. And I just want to give a shout out to a local athlete who was the highlight of the 2002 games, Joe Pack. Was in my daughter's class in high school. Just a local kid, was not expected to do what he did, and he got a silver medal in it, and it was one of the absolute highlights of the Olympics. I get chills just thinking about it, watching Joe Pack in the aerials, first time the aerials were ever held, and coming through like he did is amazing. So congratulations, Joe, if you're listening, and anybody else that's local and going for it, just do your absolute best.
Absolutely. Actually, one more question for you. Utah is looking at another Olympic bid in 2030 or 2034. Do you have any opinions on that? I know a lot of people are kind of shying away from hosting the Olympics, given how much it affects the economy. Usually cities that host it go into pretty serious debt, obviously crowding as well.
I'm kind of a little overwhelmed at what the games have become and the cost. I really think we should pare back to having it be an athletic event. I think we've gotten way too into the money aspect of it, and the expense is just absolutely overwhelming. And I wish we could still have the games, but put it on differently.
Mm-hmm. I guess in a way, this upcoming Tokyo Games will be almost that pared back event with no spectators. Obviously a lot of media there still, but it won't be the pomp and circumstance and the crazy amount of crowds that it normally is.
And I think that's a blessing. We'll be focusing on the athletes and the athletic performance in a tough time. And to be in this game would be very, very, very special.
Mm-hmm. Anything else for us, Dick?
Just glad to be here, and hello, Park City, and I love the Olympics.
Awesome. I love the Olympics, too. Well, that is Park City Olympian and 1964 Olympic gold medal swimmer, Dick Roth. Dick, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right. Well, in his monthly news conference last week, Governor Spencer Cox discussed Utah's drought and COVID-19 vaccination rates. KBCW's Ellie Fisher has more.
Governor Cox said 98% of Utah is either in extreme or exceptional drought. Utah has used up all of this year's seasonal runoff and is now relying on emergency water sources. Cox asked Utahns to only water lawns twice per week in northern Utah and three times per week in southern Utah. Water in the early mornings or evening and always prioritize trees over lawns. Cox also urged that Utah residents to forego using fireworks this Pioneer Day. He said Utahns can make a difference by sticking to these recommendations and protocols. Last week, there were 35 wildfires across the state, compared to 63 over the same time last year. 24 of last week's fires were human-caused. Cox said that he is really worried about next year's drought conditions. Utah has enough storage water to get through this year, but if the state has another year like this one, he said things could get bad. In health news, Cox urged Utah residents to get vaccinated. He said hospitalizations and fatalities are on the rise again and called the disease far worse than the vaccine. 90% to 95% of people who are contracting COVID-19 now are unvaccinated. He called it very important to see an increase in vaccinations among children statewide. So far, fewer than 30% of kids aged 12 to 15 have been vaccinated. Cox said he is working with schools and primary care physicians to get vaccine stations for children. Watch Cox's monthly governor's conference on his Facebook page.
Well, Summit County, Park City, and perhaps 20 other partners will move forward this year in a consortium to obtain 100% net renewable energy by the year 2030. Summit County Council Chair Glenn Wright says some pretty important elements are still to be worked out, including whether taxpayers will see higher or lower electric bills. Rick Bruff has more.
The renewable energy program began when the Utah legislature passed the Community Renewable Energy Act in 2019, which created a framework for local communities to get their electricity from renewable sources. Summit County and Park City teamed up with the big player in the group, Salt Lake City, to pass the legislation. Glenn Wright noted that support from Rocky Mountain Power was essential given the politics of a coal state like Utah. Wright said he believes the power company advocated for the act because it recognizes its future is in renewable energy. He said it's too soon to say whether taxpayers and participating communities will see higher or lower electric bills.
We may come out very even costs with some of the things that are going on in Washington right now. For instance, if a carbon fiend dividend plan came out of Washington, we might be paying less, because everybody's rates would go up and then be rebated through a dividend. I can't predict that's going to happen, but there's no guarantee we're going to be paying more or less. We'll determine that as the process goes on.
After the legislation was approved, 23 cities and counties approved resolutions of interest in it. All of the cities in Summit County were in that group except for Hennefer. The next step is for the participants to sign an interlocal agreement, or ILA, to join together in a planning board. Out of the 23 entities that expressed interest, 14 have taken that step, including Summit County, Park City, and Francis locally. Wright talked about what comes next in the process that will lead to Rocky Mountain Power soliciting applications, so-called requests for proposals, for renewable energy projects.
The processes for our board is to come up with a rate-making scheme that we negotiate with Rocky Mountain Power, and hopefully we can get that done through the rest of this year. That will then be sent to the Public Service Commission, which will take about 9 months to go through their process and approve it. And once that is approved, then the 23 communities have to actually pass an ordinance to adopt the program. That's when we're really locked in. At that point, Rocky Mountain Power will go out and do RFPs for building the facilities, which will probably take a number of years. I would think if we can meet this timeline, the first tranche should be in place by 2023, 2024, sometime in that time frame.
County Council Chair Glenn Wright, who said the overall cost for the participating communities to go through the regulatory process will be about $700,000. He estimated Summit County's share will be about $20,000. For KPCW, I'm Rick Baroff.
Well, new parking restrictions on Guardsman Pass went into effect this week, as KPCW's Ben Lassiter reports. Park City Municipal and Summit and Wasatch counties are working together to manage the overcrowding in that area.
Drivers are no longer allowed to park on either side of the Guardsman Pass Road. Wasatch County placed signs that say cars parked on either side of the road will be towed. Guardsman Pass is a two-lane stretch of State Route 224 that runs from the Bonanza Flats trailhead to Big Cottonwood Road at the entrance of Brighton Resort. Heinrich Dieters is the manager of Park City Trails and Open Space. He says the decision to limit parking to designated areas is an effort to curb overcrowding. This has become a focus for Park City recently, especially with an uptick in littering.
By focusing that parking in that trailhead area, we also in turn sort of limit the amount of people that are actually on the trail and hopefully improve the trail use. We have very few mechanisms or tools, but parking is a major one. And so we're really trying to work on the parking management up there.
Park City has hired two additional rangers to enforce the restrictions. In the future, Dieters says the sheriff's departments of Summit and Wasatch counties will formally share jurisdiction there. The extra law enforcement presence in the area is intended to help manage and enforce illegal parking. Starting this weekend, Utah Open Lands is enacting a public transit program that will bus people from the Park City Arts District to popular trailheads, including the Bonanza Flats trailhead. The buses will run on Saturdays and Sundays, with the first pickup scheduled for 8 a.m. and final return at 3:20 p.m. both days. The buses will make 4 round trips each day, and reservations are required. For more on how to reserve a ride with the Transit to Trails program, visit kpcw.org. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Moving on to our next Local News Hour interview, affordable housing, more affordable housing, will likely be coming to Summit County in the near future, as real estate developer CW Urban has announced a new affordable housing project called The Village, located in Silver Creek. On the line with me now to talk details, we have the division president of CW Urban, Darlene Carter, on the line with us. Good morning, Darlene.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Awesome. So let's talk about The Village. I understand this is about a 38-unit development. How many of those units will actually be affordable or attainable workforce housing?
24 of those units are going to be affordable of the 38, so a pretty good percentage.
Mm-hmm. And I'm reading through some of your materials right now. It looks like the AMI will be roughly 55 to 80% of the Summit County area median income. How did you calculate that number, and how did you decide on 55 to 80%?
Well, that's actually determined by the actual use that it's going to be. So what's interesting about these units is they're actually going to be for-sale condos affordable. So I think a lot of times when people think about affordable housing, they automatically think, okay, this is a rental situation. But we know that there's people who want to permanently live and work in Park City. And so by offering for-sale housing, this is really geared towards anybody who wants to do that, either in the workforce, you know, because that's what their income allows, and then they can live there permanently. So that determination, the range is actually set in advance by the county, and we work with the county on basically an agreement, and we say, hey, these units are going to be this percentage of AMI, and then we'll put those out to the market and then do a vetting process to see, you know, who qualifies for that.
Mm-hmm. And I know certainly in Park City proper and in the greater Summit County area, some of those AMI calculations can be kind of skewed by the amount of extremely high net worth people here. Did you run into any of those problems as well, kind of finding that AMI percentage?
Yeah, I mean, the AMI is definitely is definitely skewed by that. I want to say the AMI is like 101,000 and it's updated every year. But that being said, a workforce unit is so much less than a current market rate unit that it's definitely going to be the most affordable option in the entire county. And looking at potentially what our projected sales price are or sales prices are, I mean, it's anywhere that could be half of the normal market rate revenue. So it's going to be a great deal for those homeowners who are able to snag these units.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that the village will be part of the greater Silver Creek development area. Have these units been approved to be constructed already, or do you still have to go through the planning department and county council process before you break ground on this?
Yeah, good question. They're actually already under construction. So we're just getting the word out right now because they're going to be completed prior to the end of the year. And so we're going to be rolling out a marketing effort so people can, in the next 60 days, find out how they can qualify to obtain one of those units, because somebody could potentially be living in one of these units by January 1st.
Oh, wow. So coming up pretty fast.
Yeah.
Have you guys had any reach out from potential buyers already?
We haven't owned, but that's on me. And we actually haven't started the process. You know, in the past, with these workforce housing units or affordable units, they really go so quickly that we're just trying to time it right. So prior to them being available, we're really getting the word out and starting the vetting process so that people can plan accordingly. Because as you mentioned, we actually are through the city process and zoning, and that and construction takes a lot of time, and there's unfortunately oftentimes several delays, especially this year with all the construction supply chain issues. So we're just trying to get the word out when we have a really clear picture of when residents can actually move in the properties, and then they'll be able to plan their life accordingly.
That actually leads me to my next question. Given how much construction costs have ballooned over the past 18 months, has that affected kind of the build price and the final price of some of these units?
Well, it actually hasn't, and that's the good news for the homeowner. So when we do an affordable housing unit, it is a set price based on the AMI. So has it affect our ability to execute? Has it affect our ability to make any dollars out of this project? Sure, because, I mean, in some cases, you know, lumber is tripled, or every single construction cost is up 10 to 20%, but none of those prices are passed on to the end user, and their price is going to be locked in based on what the AMI calculation is for 2021.
Mm-hmm. And we have seen some reports that have talked about lumber and other building material prices actually coming down a little bit since more people are coming back to work, more lumber is getting milled. Have you guys seen any of those trends at all?
You know, unfortunately, I would say that's probably the one trend that I wish we would see more of that we haven't. I appreciate, you know, that futures is coming down, and that is an indicator that lumber price will soften. However, what we pay for on the lumber price is really based off of the stock that the yard has in available in their current inventory right now. So there's generally up to a 90 day, if not more, lag time on that. In addition, futures is not based off of the whole lumber package. So there's certain wood engineered products that are part of any apartment or home or residence that aren't necessarily calculated in the futures price. And those are the ones that are on allocation or very difficult to get. They have resins in them. They're composite. So will we see some softening? Yes. Have I been able to cut that budget by 60% like the news articles would suggest? Absolutely not. But I'm looking forward to a future that lumber is a little bit more modestly priced.
Absolutely. I think everybody is who's looking to build anything these days.
For sure.
Uh-huh. And as we were talking about previously, affordable workforce housing is in huge demand and huge need in the Wasatch back. But there also has been a bit of pushback from the public, at least in the greater Summit County area. I'm thinking of the proposed Highland Flat development. When you were going through this process with the Planning Commission and the County Council, was there pushback from residents who maybe didn't want the development and the density of affordable housing?
Yeah, I mean, there always is resistance from the greater community because I think the notion is, or the thought process, is that they feel like it's going to somehow affect their property values. But the truth is that just hasn't seemed to be the case. You know, I have to give hats off to Matt Lowe and the master plan developers of Silver Creek. They were in the entitlement process on this project. You know, there's a joke that I think has some truth to it since the early 80s. And in all of Silver Creek development, 20% of the units are going to have an affordable component or be considered a workforce unit. And I think that it's really interesting how these communities come together because this is actually, we have a variety of affordable products that are going in. The bulk of them is this condo project that we're speaking of. But there's a few townhomes and even one single family that we're going to be building over the next year that's affordable. And that unit is selling for, like I mentioned, double the price as a next door neighbor 10 feet away. And I think the notion that someone's property value would go down because somebody had a workforce unit simply isn't true. It hasn't affected the insatiable appetite for the people who want market rate units in the county.
Yeah. And where can people find some more information on the village if they're interested in maybe submitting an offer once these things go on the market?
You can find all the information about our projects at builtbycw.com. And this project, again, as you mentioned, is named The Village. And we'll have all the links when it's available on how to qualify for these units. And we'll be helping potential residents every step of the way so they can go through the process and see if they are able to qualify.
Wonderful. Anything else for us, Darlene?
I just appreciate your time and having me on the line.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. That's Division President of Real Estate Developer CW Urban, Darlene Carter, talking about the Village Affordable Housing Project. Darlene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. All have right. A great day.
Take care. Joining us in the studio now, we have the Director of the Snyderville Basin Recreation District, Dana Jones, with a monthly update. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning, Sean. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So what is going on around Snyderville Basin for recreation?
You know, this is really our busy time of the year. It's just wonderful to see that the hundreds of kids that we're serving every week in all the different camps, you know, everything from tennis camps to their swimming, their rafting, they're just all over the place. Every time I look out my office window, you see just a bunch of kids running by, and it's just been really great to watch.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking back a year ago, summer camps for kids was a huge question mark given everything that was going on. Still, obviously, COVID is still a part of our lives. People are getting vaccinated now, though. But what was it, almost a sigh of relief that things were maybe a little bit less hectic this summer, or have things still been pedal to the metal 100%?
You know, it's really kind of interesting because we did have camps last summer, just you know, we had less kids in them. I wasn't here then. I didn't arrive until late December. But this year, I think our challenge has just been finding staff. Our challenge is not finding the kids. We have wait lists for just about everything that we're doing. It's finding staff. So I would say it's even more pedal to the metal this year because we've got people that are going outside their box, and the people that are usually in the office working at their desks are now driving vans, but they're just having a great time because they're getting out and spending some time with the kids, and it really reminds you of what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Absolutely. So what kind of employees are you looking for right now, then?
Right now, actually, that's a really good question. we're always looking for things like fitness instructors, lifeguards, folks to work at the field house, but we are also hiring a couple of full-time positions right now. So we are looking for an administrative manager, and we're looking for an open space supervisor, and we're going to be looking for a couple other full-time positions possibly in the field house. So if anyone's looking for work, we have great benefits, and we would just love to have you apply, because it's just an awesome place to be.
Absolutely. And where can people go to apply for these positions?
They can go to our website, basinrecreation.org, and I think you look under the other tab, and you can find the employment stuff, so you can see all the different positions we're hiring for. You'll find right there.
Absolutely. Sounds like some great opportunities over there, not only to spend some time outside, but also maybe start a career with you guys.
And it is a great career, I'll tell you. And it's a great team. I mean, everybody is just like a big family over there, and it's helps each other out and works together. And so if you want a job that's fun as well as a career, then it's probably the good place to go.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the team over there, I actually spoke with Matt Wagoner in the Trails Department about e-bikes and how some of that stuff has been happening over in kind of Park City in the Snyderville Basin. Obviously, that's a lot of people have strong opinions on both sides of that. How is Snyderville kind of approaching that issue? And I know enforcement is a big problem kind of everywhere with these things. It's a dicey topic. Would you like to comment on that?
Thank you very much. I have my little notes here that you said, we're going to talk about these things, and that was not one of them. But you know what? This is, and I told my board president just over the past couple of weeks, I said, this is something they were going to have to be dealing with, because it's something that's really popping up. It's also something that we're working pretty closely with Mountain Trails Foundation on, because all of our trails run into each other. And so the worst thing to be would be to have the public not know going from one thing to another. If can I be on this trail? Can I not be on this trail? And the last thing we want to do is put signs up every 5 feet saying, you know, do this, don't do this. But e-mountain bikes are definitely, can be a conflict on the trails, not only with the hikers, but also with other mountain bikers, because other mountain bikers are going up a very steep hill, obviously very slowly, because they're having to pedal, and when an e-mountain bike comes blazing by them, it doesn't create very good feelings on that side. So one thing we're really looking at, and this, it also kind of goes back to, we have so many people using our trails. You know, we have hikers, we have mountain bikers, we have the e-mountain bikers, we have horseback riders, we have people who are trail runners, that we're really going to probably start looking in the future of designing trails for specific uses. So we've already started talking with Mountain Trails Foundation about how can we look at designing some e-bike trails. So trails that are specifically for that, trails with some good sight distance, so you don't have to worry about coming around a corner and running into someone. Trails that give them the length of the ride that they want. And I think that's probably going to be our future, because right now we do not allow e-bikes on the basin recreation trails.
Mm-hmm. And I understand, talking about some of those use-specific trails, you recently completed a hiking-only trail.
We did. We did complete a hiking-only trail, the NMA trail from the Overland Trailhead. And we are going to be doing more of those. We're looking at possibly another hiking-only trail out by the Flying Dog to try to to give those mountain bikers possibly a mountain biking only trail, because they're asking for direction specific trails also. We want this hill to be downhill, or this trail to be downhill only, and this trail to be uphill only. And those blend better when it's a specific use trail rather than a multiple use trail.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, kind of permeating the news over this summer has been Utah's drought. Obviously, a lot of water shortages going on right now. What is the basin doing to mitigate its water use, and how does this drought affect the trails? Obviously, a lot of dust. Does that make the trails deteriorate more than usual when it's dry like this?
You know, we haven't really been seeing that yet. And the trails here, as opposed to where I came from, because they're covered with snow several months out of the year, they really do have a chance to kind of heal themselves and come back. They're not beat to death, 12 months out of the year. So we're not really seeing. The biggest thing that impacts the trails is just the massive amounts of use that we're getting and the different types of use that we're getting. But we are, our biggest concern obviously during the drought is our playing fields, because grass takes a tremendous amount of water. And so we're very happy that we have a turf field, which does not take water, the artificial turf. And we are building two more fields over at Trailside that will also be turf. But we're looking to the future too. Are we going to need to change over some of our grass fields to turf fields so that in the future we won't have as much of an issue with water and they're more playable for longer period of time during the year? But right now we are cutting back on our water usage. You might see our fields starting to look not so green and lush. And if we have to cut back more as the summer goes on, we might have to start cutting back on the use of those fields. But we're working really closely with our stakeholders and the groups that use the fields. They have been awesome to work with, totally understanding on what we're doing, and we're just trying to make sure we can get everybody out there recreating and still be able to provide a safe playing field.
Mm-hmm. I understand some bike racks have also been installed at various trailheads around the basin. What's the thought behind putting a bike rack at a trailhead if people maybe want to go mountain biking, or are they biking to the trail and then hiking, or what's the thought process behind some of that?
What we're looking for is folks to bike to the trail and then hike, and especially maybe some of those folks with e-bikes. So that would keep them from driving a car, parking in some of the neighborhoods that we're having issues with overcrowding. So if you have your e-bike, ride it to the trailhead, lock it up to the bike racks, and go for your hike. Come on back and take a leisurely ride home. The other way we're trying to get people to those trailheads without their cars are using the new High Valley Transit and the micro transit routes. Call up yourself a car, get to the trailhead. You can even do a one-way hike. Start at one trailhead, hike out to another one, call and get a ride back home. It's really a great opportunity, and we're hoping to be able to do a lot more partnering with that.
That sounds like an incredible idea. Lots of options out there for us these days.
That's what we're hoping.
So I understand some over 50 activities, some signups for fall activities coming up as well?
Yeah, you know, we have some great mountain biking clinics and mountain biking rides for the Fun Over 50 group. We are getting ready for signups for fall activities. So if you're looking for soccer or flag football, those things are going to be coming up, and the signups are going to be opening up in the next few weeks before I get back on with you.
Wonderful. Sounds like a lot going on over at the Basin Recreation. Anything else for us?
You know, it's been a great summer, and we're looking forward to fall. And if anyone has any questions, we have a lot of good stuff going on our website. But you can always stop in and talk to any of our staff. They're always willing to talk to people and share things.
Wonderful. And if you're looking for a job, Basin Recreation is hiring.
Yes, we are.
Awesome. Dana, thank you so much for joining us this morning. So nice to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, a member of the Park City Council is saying it will step back from a proposal for a soil repository in Park City along State Route 248. An overwhelming amount of negative feedback at last week's public hearing is putting the brakes on the project. Thursday's work session and public hearing was a chance for the council to officially take the public's temperature on the controversial proposal to build a soil repository along State Route 248. The site is intended for the storage of dirt containing chemicals like lead and arsenic left over from Park City's mining town history. After an hour and a half of input, the response from the public was unified in opposition to the proposal. Not one person spoke up in support of the project. Councilor Max Doyle told KPCW he and his colleagues have considered the public's concerns and will begin looking at other options going forward.
Well, we're definitely taking a step back. I mean, we've heard the community loud and clear. We're going to look at all of our options.
Mining waste excavated in Park City is currently transported to a facility in the West Desert of Tooele County at a significant cost. In an effort to be more fiscally and environmentally responsible, the city wants to build a local site to store soil excavated for city development projects. City documents estimate such a change could save over $17 million over the next 10 years. With the public showing no appetite for a facility in Park City, options are limited to exploring alternate sites closer than Tooele County. The hearing was widely attended, with 17 speakers sharing their thoughts, including several candidates for city council. Donnie Novell said she's lived in Park City for 50 years and went as far to say she has not seen a worse idea proposed by the city.
I have voted for all of you, some of you several times. In the years I have been here, I have seen amazing things coming out of City Hall that have benefited our entire town, just like Bonanza Flat was. Downright corruption in the 70s that benefited a few. I feel the repository is the absolute worst idea I have ever heard coming from leadership at City Hall.
The city wrapped up a 60-day project outreach period with the public this week and held several in-person and virtual events presenting the facts and figures of the proposal. Donnelly said the process has been thought-provoking. Experts brought in by city staff to explain the safety of the proposed site have said the project would be relatively low risk and a responsible way for Park City to take care of the problem soil on its own. But the community was not convinced.
It's really interesting coming in here and trying to be, trying to represent the community, right? We get a lot of information from a lot of experts. And normally in my regular daily life, I take the expert opinion and I go, God, that makes a lot of sense. That person knows a lot more about this than I do. And I usually go with that, regardless of my opinion on it. Opinions seem to have driven this into a different direction. And so we're going to have to go with what the community said. That's what we're elected to do. And I'm happy to do that.
No binding decisions were made by the council on the future of the project Thursday night, but Doyle Lee indicated it is unlikely the project will move forward in its current form.